All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Sandy Nelson with Let There Be Drums, and that's what we need today. I want all the drums beating all over the city, all over the country. Get those drums loud and clear and waking people up and reminding them to open up their ears to wherever they are. Turn on that radio, sit down next to the radio, fire up the computer, whatever you got to do to access this show. You got to do it because we have a very special show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with filmmaker Kalyani Mam, director of A River Changes Course. Now, this is a really beautiful film. I saw it up at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and it won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for documentaries at Sundance. It's a really beautiful film and a deeply thoughtful film about the impact of clear-cutting and overfishing and sweatshop development on people in Cambodia by tracing the lives of three families and how this intersects with all of that. So you don't want to miss that. That's going to be a very interesting conversation. And opening the show up, I'm very, very pleased to be bringing you part four of the five-part interview I did with Bob Avakian a little while ago. In this part of the interview, we concentrate on the question of whether it's really possible to have a liberated socialist society with whole new ways of relating to each other and to the world, and a society that's actually on its way to, that's struggling to get to, a communist world, a world where people, human beings, are truly emancipated. And in digging into this question, we get into questions like, what about human nature with all of its me first and screw the rest of you outlook? And what is revolutionary morality, and what difference will that make in a socialist society? Now, like I said, this is part four of the five-part interview. And if you missed any of the first three parts, go to revcom.us. Again, that's revcom.us, where you'll have access to all three segments. And a whole lot more about the movement for revolution that Bob Avakian is leading. So without any further ado, listen up and let's get into it. Bob Avakian being interviewed by me, Michael Slate.
One of the things that is, again, very important in terms of being able to get there, to get to a new society in the first place, is having a vision, having actually an idea of that, and people broadly having an idea of this society, both in it being visionary, but also in it being viable. The fact that there's actually this possibility, that it's a real possibility, that it's viable, that people can look at what's been done. And a big part, and that actually plays into a lot in terms of this, again, this question of hammering away at this notion of we can't do any better than where we are now. You know, and there's a whole point that you've done. You've done all this work in the new synthesis of communism that you've developed and brought out into the world, and the idea that what the society can be, looking at the experience of the past and figuring out the problems that it had and correcting that and developing whole new pathways to actually create the kind of society that you've said and others have said is not only, it's not only a new society, but it's a place. It's a place that people would want to live, and they could actually live with the dignity of human beings, and be part of a process of creating a society, of a transition, of a transformation, a society that's in transformation to something that would be the emancipation of humanity as a whole. And like I'm saying, that's something that's really come out as something that's very important in people's thinking, and they're being able to take up and get involved in this kind of movement, this idea that it's not just about throwing out your anger or striking out or getting, what's in it for me or anything like that, but the idea of being able to create this new society. At the same time, there's a lot of questions. There's a point here where a lot of people, as you said, you talked about the ideological revenge against communism, and that's led to a lot of different things about, people being unsure of what they would be heading into, people being a little nervous about the unknown of what lies ahead of them, and thinking about it in terms of, I know what I got here, I don't know what I have there, and there's a little bit of among some people, there can be a little bit of not being very sure about that. At the same time, they raise all these questions about, that come out, that are things that are really, I guess, I'm trying to think about this. There are things that are actually really gnawing in their brains. For instance, one big question that comes out, I've heard this from more than one person, many people actually, is the idea that, look, you can talk all you want about a new society, you can talk all you want about a new vision for humanity, but at the same time, there is a question of human nature. And people talk about that not just in the question of this sort of definable core of human nature, but they also talk about it in terms of people will do screwed up things, no matter what. And how will all that be dealt with? How can you actually deal with this kind of question? How can you bring a society in that would take into account this fact, and what would you do about it?
Well, you know, obviously these are big questions and deserve to be taken seriously and dug into. And this needs to happen in an ongoing way beyond what we can do here. But in our party, it does continue to address this. One of the main things that I've been speaking to in talks and writings, including a talk I gave not long ago, birds cannot give birth to crocodiles, but humanity can soar beyond the horizon, where I address the question of how the nature of the system, and most fundamentally the economic system, shapes the quote-unquote nature of the people in it. That is, the very character and dynamics of that system, or the system we live under of capitalism, is a system based on exploitation, oppressive social relations between men and women, between different nationalities or races, as they're sometimes referred to. It rests on a fundamental division between people, a small group of people, relatively, who work with their minds, and in the realm of ideas and intellectual endeavor, and the great majority who are forced to work in physical labor, and other divisions in the world. All this is what this system rests on, thrives on, and reproduces and enforces. And it also brings forward the ideas that correspond to that and that reinforce that, and the culture. It's a system and a society based not only on exploitation and oppression, but on cutthroat competition at every level of society, including the highest level, where the different aggregations of capital, finance capital and corporate capital and so on, battle each other all over the world, in which this even results in wars as well as the destruction of the environment. That's the way the system, that's the nature of the system, if you will. And it produces a culture and shapes and influences the thinking of people to go along with and serve and reinforce that system. So the nature of the system conditions and shapes the nature of the human beings who are confined within and forced to live within the dynamics of that system. That's a very fundamental point. And, you know, Marx made the point, founder of the communist movement, made the point some time ago, 150 years ago or so, that, as he put it, all of human history is the continuous transformation of human nature, that different societies are characterized by different cultures and different ways of thinking, which are fundamentally rooted in and correspond to the way that the economic mode of life, the way that the system organizes and conditions people and requires people to carry out economic activity in order to live in keeping with the dynamics and requirements of that system. So that under slavery, for example, it was held to be the human nature of the slaves that slavery corresponded by the rulers of a society and the dominating ideas, that this corresponded to the nature of the slaves and was actually in their best interest. These arguments were frequently made, especially by the slave owners and their representatives. Or in feudal society, there was the divine right of kings and the right of the nobles to rule over the lowly serfs and even to plunder the women of the serfs. All this was considered in keeping with God's will and the inherent and unchangeable nature of human beings. You know, then along came the bourgeois revolution, the capitalist revolutions, including the American, and you got people like Thomas Paine representing a class of people rising who wanted to break off the fetters, at least some of the fetters of feudal restriction that kept the capitalist system from fully developing and hemmed it in, and including the whole superstructure of political rule of feudal society with monarchs and so on. So you got Thomas Paine, a radical in the context of the American bourgeois revolution, who vigorously argued against the whole notion of the right of monarchs to rule and divine right of kings and so on, and insisted, not without any reason, that this was a terrible system, that one of the things that could result from having hereditary kings and monarchs was that you could get mentally defective people and idiots, as well as very bad people, having a absolute right, divinely inspired, to rule. So the nature that was held to be unchallengeable under the feudal system, with the, you know, enshrined and reinforced with the notion of a divine right of kings, got called into question fundamentally through the capitalist revolution, which wanted to break off the ways in which the limitations of feudalism and the way that the land was owned by landlords who, you know, and things were very static and the trade that could be carried out was restricted by all these different feudal manors that were divided up and kept them from fully developing the capitalist system, not only in the country, but in its international dimension and so on and so forth. The idea got challenged by the representatives of the bourgeois revolution, with whom we're all too familiar, one might say, whether Paine or Jefferson or whatever, that this whole idea of a monarchy and an static society where everybody's place was sort of predetermined, everybody had a place they were supposed to stay in, was challenged and overturned, both in the realm of the actual economic and political relations, but also in the realm of ideas. And these people brought forward the notion of a much more mobile society where capital could move from one place to another and people could move from one place to another according to the needs of capital. And they, just as happens today, you get immigrants forced to go thousands of miles chasing capital, in effect, to try to be able to find a livelihood when they're unable to any longer live where they are under the capitalist system. Capitalism needs a much more mobile workforce. It needs a workforce that isn't tied to a particular piece of land or a particular master. So the whole idea of that kind of static feudal society with these rigid delineations of different strata, you know, with everybody in their place up from bottom to top, was challenged and overturned under capitalism. And the notions of human nature that went along with that were also challenged and overturned. This is what Marx is getting at. Aha, somebody might say. The problem is, though, that even with all that, there is a thread that seems to be running through all this, which is the notion that some people should rule over and exploit others and have superior positions over others, even if it's not in the form of slavery or in the form of feudalism, as you just described it, but now in the form of modern-day society, whether they call it capitalism or democracy or whatever, where still you have some ruling over others, some people in a superior position, other people in an inferior position. And among all strata in society, people seem to be scrambling to try to beat each other out for whatever they deem to be their needs or their desires and aspirations. And there's some truth to that, of course. There's an essential truth to that even, because what this system has in common, while it has many differences with feudalism or with outright slavery, this capitalist system is still a system based on exploitation and oppression, and still a system which drives people to be in conflict with each other over the daily necessities of life, to get a job, to get a place to live, for all the other things that people are driven to compete with each other over. So there is, even in this modern society, ways in which people are, to put it in terms in which it's often popularly put, people are selfish and out for themselves. Not because there's some unchangeable core to human beings that prevents them from being some other and better way, but because of the very dynamics of the system in which they are caught up and in which they're forced to live, which drives them to seek to gain advantage over others or to be pushed down by others who get advantage over them.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this is part four of the five-part interview I recently did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this section of the interview deals with the question of, is it really possible to have a liberated socialist society with whole new ways of relating to each other and to the world, especially given the ideas that people have about human nature with all of its me first and screw the rest of you outlook? And also the question of what is revolutionary morality and what difference will it make in socialist society? Now, as I said earlier, this is part four of the five-part interview. If you've missed any of the first three parts, go to revcom.us.
And, I think, for example, in contrast to all that, when I went to China for the first time in 1971, we visited some of the rural areas where the peasants had gotten together and developed the people's communes, where they owned the land and worked the land in common, and their livelihood was increasingly improving. They were able to bring in more technology, more machinery, and continue to develop their output and contribute not only to their own well-being, but to the general development of society, and also to contribute to the world revolution by the support that was given by the central government to, for example, the Vietnamese struggle against the U.S. imperialists who were devastating the land and slaughtered several million people in the course of that war. And we were talking to some of these peasants who had their sights raised to much bigger things than just their own immediate circumstances and struggle, even while that, of course, remained something that they had to be and were concerned about. And people would tell us stories about how in the old society, most people were desperately poor, and there was mass starvation many years. I mean, the whole propaganda of this whole ideological assault what I call the ideological revenge against communism, is somehow everybody was doing wonderfully in China, and everybody had lots of, you know, a surplus of everything they needed and had lots of luxury goods as well. And along came the communists and took it all away and caused everybody to suffer, which is, of course, the exact opposite of the truth. The reason people rallied to the leadership of the communists and made a revolution is because their conditions were the opposite of that. They were horrific, and people were dying of disease. People were dying of starvation many years. People were living in extreme hardship, even in the quote-unquote best of years, in their masses in the countryside. And the peasants there told us, when I visited in 1971, when we went around from one commune to another, that look, in the old society, if we were lucky, we owned a small plot of land which we could make a meager existence off of, if we could even have that. We had, in the harsh winter, we had cotton clothes that had more holes than cloth in them, and we had to try to pad them, but we were always cold. We were always on the verge of starvation, if not literally in starvation. Some of us had the horror of having to sell some of our children to landlords, or girl children who were sold into prostitution in order that other members of the family could survive. This is what our life was like. And as part of this, on our little meager plots of land, with the very small output that we could get from them, particularly at harvest time, everybody would stay up at night, or one member of the family at least would stay up at night to guard the plot and the output of the plot from their neighbors, because everybody was so desperate. People at each other's throats even on that level. But, they said, after the revolution came, there was a complete change of the economic system, of the political system. We became involved in the actual decision-making on the local level, but also contributing to that on the larger level of society. The relations changed between men and women. We began to collectivize the land and work it together and have a much better livelihood. Now nobody even would think about worrying about whether their neighbors are going to steal from them that way. Not that there's never any crime, or not that anybody never does anything selfish, but as a social problem, this no longer exists the way it did in the old society. Nobody would ever think that everybody on their own little small plot should stay up all night guarding it against their neighbors. And now, with the reversal of the revolution in China, after Mao died and the followers of Deng Xiaoping and Deng Xiaoping himself came to power, and the restoration of capitalism in that country and the turning of China, in fact, into a giant sweatshop for foreign imperialist capital as well as Chinese capital, all these conditions that people had won through the revolutionary struggle have been reversed. China went from having the most egalitarian healthcare system in the entire world during the period of socialism to having one of the most unequal healthcare systems, where everything is geared toward the wealthier strata of society and poor people, once again, have no decent healthcare. And we could go on and on just sketching out the ways in which this has thrown people back into the miserable conditions of the old society. Prostitution once again, drug addiction once again, big social problems where they had been eliminated as social problems in the socialist revolution, not by eliminating the former prostitutes or drug addicts, but by transforming the conditions, rehabilitating them, and by carrying out a struggle and education in society to make people broadly aware and to act on the understanding that the fact of women being prostitutes and people being drug addicts was not their own fault and should not be their own shame, but was the cause of the system, the rule of imperialism and the Chinese exploiters tied in with the imperialists, and the whole system which put people into these desperate conditions. All those kind of social things and the thinking that goes along with them, like prostitution, drug addiction, those kind of social problems and scourges have come back. And once again, the ideology of everybody being out for themselves has come back. And I think of a dramatic, you know, it would almost be humorous if it weren't so perverse, a story I heard about two party members in the Chinese Communist Party, some years after Deng Xiaoping came to power and capitalism was restored. And they were talking, and one of them said to the other, "You know, back in the days of Mao, we used to talk about serving the people. That was what the revolution was supposed to be about. That was what the government was supposed to be about. That's what the Chinese Communist Party was supposed to be about. That was sort of the defining principle and guiding principle of the whole society. But now I think about it, and when I think about serve the people, it occurs to me, aren't I a people? And, you know, the whole idea of going out for yourself once more, once you get to, you know, the change in the whole nature of the government and the system brings back the old, quote unquote, human nature. But this is not because this is an indelible thing in human beings that can't be changed, but it changed, and it's another illustration of Marx's point that he got it when he said that all of human history is a transformation of human nature, that when the system is changed, then people's thinking also changes. Their way of relating to other people changes in accordance with the nature of the system that's been brought into being. In the case of a socialist revolution, a conscious activity of people. But if that revolution gets reversed, if a coup gets pulled from the top, which happened in China, and then the destruction of the socialist system is enforced now by the state that's ruled by these capitalist rotors, as Mao correctly called them, then you're going to get a new set of social and economic relations and a new way and a new culture to reinforce that and a new way of thinking, even among people who once again, once knew much better.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this is part four of the five-part interview I recently did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this section of the interview deals with the question of, is it really possible to have a liberated socialist society with whole new ways of relating to each other and to the world, especially given the ideas that people have about human nature with all of its me first and screw the rest of you outlook? And also the question of what is revolutionary morality and what difference will it make in socialist society? Now, as I said earlier, this is part four of the five-part interview. If you've missed any of the first three parts, go to revcom.us.
Tell me this. What about morality? Yeah, you know, because there's a question. It's not exactly the same as the...
I'm for it.
Okay, let me mark that down. But, you know, you have a point in a way with all gods. And believe me, I've had many a discussion around this. You had the point about science can tell what is and what could be, but not what should be. And you talked about morality. And
right.
I keep thinking about that in relation to this point, getting away from even the human nature question, the idea that people aren't angels, people do things. The question of morality in a socialist society.
Yeah, when I said I'm for it, I'm for a revolutionary morality. You need a revolutionary morality, a socialist and a communist morality, if you're going to be able to actually make a revolution and bring into being a radically different socialist society and continue on the road toward eliminating all the inequalities and oppressive divisions that you've, to put it that way, inherited from the old capitalist society and then move on to a communist world, including the oppressive divisions between different countries that are part of the world we live in today very dramatically. So you need a revolutionary morality to be a guiding force in that, a morality that corresponds to the goal of actually overcoming and moving beyond all these oppressive divisions and inequalities. You need a morality that corresponds to that and that inspires people to fight for that. But it's true, simply the application of a scientific method and approach will not in itself settle the question of morality. And I think sometimes there's been a mechanical approach where people have thought, well, if you just have a science of communism, you'll automatically have the morality that goes along with it. And so morality is sort of irrelevant. And I think that's really wrong. And if we could use that term reductionist, it's vulgar materialist, if you want to put it that way. It's only looking at one element of the situation and thinking that in and of itself sort of automatically determines every other element. That if you have a new system, you'll sort of automatically have a new morality. And that's not true. There is a question of fighting in the realm of morality. What kind of morality are we going to have? And, you know, I think the question of science, let's put it this way. In a discussion with someone, I put it this way. In order to arrive at an understanding of why the world is the way it is, well, first of all, how it actually is and why it is the way it is and what can anything be done about that and what can be done and how. In order to answer those basic questions correctly and get to the core of this, not that you'll know everything about all that, but to get to the core of it and essence of it, you need a scientific approach, and in particular the scientific approach of communism, which investigates, probes, and proceeds in accordance with actually trying to understand reality as it actually is and as it's moving through its contradictory motion and changing on that basis. And then, you know, acting in accordance with that to make changes in the way that actually is possible given that material reality. That's the point about communism. It's not just some utopian ideas. The point is that the conditions that have been brought into being in the world, not conditions that were bound to occur or an inevitable result of some human development or some master plan of a god or nature or whatever, but that way things have actually developed. The technology, the knowledge that exists, the interconnectedness and interdependence of human beings, even though this is now under a highly oppressive system which leads to all kinds of inequalities among those human beings. But the fact that we're interconnected, interdependent, all that provides the material basis, if you analyze it scientifically, to make the leap first to socialism and then to go on to overcome the remaining inequalities, both in particular countries and in the world, and get to communism. If you analyze it scientifically, you can see that possibility as well as that necessity in order to really meet the needs of the great majority and ultimately all of humanity. But you can also analyze or recognize, in any case, in basic terms, the same conditions, the same reality that we've been discussing here, and decide to do nothing about it because your position is relatively comfortable, or because you feel that even though you don't like all that, it requires too much sacrifice, or you don't think the prospect is realistic. Now, the science will help you determine whether or not the prospect is actually realistic, whether there's a basis in the real world to do this, even though it may be very difficult and require tremendous and in many ways wrenching struggle. But that science won't tell you what to do with that knowledge. There does enter in the realm where there has to be struggle in the realm of morality. That's where the realm of morality enters in, and the necessity for struggle in the realm of morality. And as I put it to someone in a discussion, science does not settle the question of morality and what to do with what science reveals about the world and reality. There is a need for morality to take the next leap in terms of what you're going to do about what you've come to understand. But if your morality flows from assumptions, or in any case is out of keeping with the actual reality and is in conflict with actual reality, then sooner or later, your morality is bound to lead you in a wrong direction, even if your intentions are good. So science doesn't settle the question of morality. There still is the realm of morality in its own right, so to speak, and the necessity for struggle to win people to a revolutionary, to a communist morality. But all that has to have a scientific foundation. Otherwise, even with the best of intents, you're going to go off course and lead people, you know, in the wrong direction. So that's how I see that. There is a very great importance to morality. Now, I know what you sort of were, you know, implying here or you know, were suggesting is that many people say, well, what you're talking about sounds good, but it only work if people were angels, quote unquote. This is the old thing, if, you know, if it used to be said in the old days, if men were angels. You know, if people were angels, then okay, we wouldn't need, you know, the kind of society we have. But once again, we're back to, since people are not angels, they're basically selfish and out for self above all, etc., then we can't have the kind of society you're talking about. We have to have a society that corresponds to that. And lo and behold, guess what? It's the society we have now. So, you know, but then let's go directly to this question. Do people have to be, quote-unquote, perfect or angels in order for this revolution and its goal of first socialism and ultimately a communist world to actually be realized? No.
Yep, that's where we're ending. No. Do people have to be angels or be perfect in order for this revolution and its goal of first socialism and then a communist world to be realized? No. And we'll pick it up right there next week as he goes on to explain why he says that. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you've been listening to an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, just a little while ago. And this is the part 4 of 5 segments. If you've missed any of the first 3 segments, and if you want to just get this segment to, you know, download it, have it to you so you can take it out to your friends and whatnot, visit revcom.us, that's revcom.us, all right? And you'll get all you need there. You can download the whole interview as it plays, and you'll get a whole lot more information about this movement for revolution that's led by Avakian. We're going to take a quick break. Well, actually, it's not such a quick break. We're going to take a break for station ID, and then we're going to go into a musical break. And I wanted to go into this musical break. It's a kind of an extended musical break because after all this talk about morality and human nature, I thought this is a perfect song to play in order to just keep the spirit going, keep the theme going, all right? It's from Frank Turner, and it's called Glory Hallelujah. And when we come back, we'll be talking with filmmaker Kalyani Mam about her award-winning film, A River Changes Course. So stay tuned.
Brothers and sisters, have you heard the news? The storm has lifted and there's nothing to lose. So swap your confirmation for your dancing shoes, because there never was no God. Step out of the darkness and onto the streets. Forget about the fast, let's have a carnival feast. Raise up your lowered head and hear the liberation beat, because there never was no God. And there is no God. So clap your hands together. There is no God. No heaven and no hell. And there is no God. We're all in this together. There is no God. So ring that victory. Until we die, until we restitute the meek, no blaming all our failings on imaginary beasts, because there never was no God. The fighting of a land your distant fathers told you of, no spilling blood for those who never spread a drop of love. The finger pointing justified by phantoms up above, because there never was no God. Say there never was no God. There is no God. So clap your hands together. There is no.
All right, that's Glory Hallelujah from Frank Turner, known to many as the Bruce Springsteen of England. I tell you, this is a song I dare say that very few people have ever heard a song that's so not defensive and so right out there, talking about atheism and talking about dealing with the real world once we get away from the make-believe. All right. Some of you know I spent the last couple of weeks up at the Sundance Film Festival. And as part of being there, I saw quite a few really good films, films that made me think, made me question a lot of things, opened my eyes up in a lot of ways. And one in particular I was very pleased to see. It's a very beautiful film. It's a film that's heartbreakingly beautiful and deeply thoughtful. And it's by filmmaker Kalyani Mam, and she's the filmmaker and director of the film A River Changes Course, which won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries. And it was a well-deserved win. And really, as I said, hopefully you'll get a chance to see this sometime soon. But right now, I'm very pleased to welcome Kalyani Mam to the show today to talk about her film, A River Changes Course. Kalyani, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, Michael. How are you? Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure. Thank you for being here. I'm very good today. I'm feeling really, really, I'm feeling very high.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, I was going to do a brief intro, but I thought maybe you could do this better, because your film does trace the impact of a lot of massive changes that are impacting the people of Cambodia and, by extension, people in much of the world, what they call the non-developed or the undeveloped world or whatever, the world that actually is going through massive changes because of the impacts of a whole global system of exploitation and oppression. And I wanted you to talk about, give people a sense of what your film is about, because it's a fairly unique take on all this.
Mm, Yes, thank you. So a river changes course actually follows the lives of three young Cambodians and their struggles against the impact of globalization, most particularly the impact of deforestation, overfishing, and overwhelming debt in Cambodia. However, as you say, it takes on a very interesting and a unique perspective, you know, on that impact, because the film actually follows these lives, you know, very closely and shows the beauty of their lives, you know, which I think most of us are and don't really have an opportunity to see. And I think by focusing on the beauty of their lives, we're able to understand and realize the significance of protecting that beauty.
You know, you've had a lot of experience. I mean, aside from being born in Cambodia and many times back there and whatnot, you've had a lot of experience with this. What compelled you to make this particular film?
Well, yes, I've been traveling back and forth between the U.S. and Cambodia for a long time. I was actually born in Cambodia. But I grew up, you know, hearing a lot of stories from my family about Cambodia, and I've always, you know, been intrigued by my history and my background. The first time I went to Cambodia was actually in 1998, during the summer of my junior year in college, and I was compelled to return to my country because I wanted to find out, you know, where I'm from and where I belong. I never really felt like I belonged in the United States. You know, growing up, I always felt like I was you know, divided in half. but going back to Cambodia was really the most incredible experience. You know, I understood, you know, the beauty that my family was talking about. I actually had the opportunity to travel all around the country and to see the country and the landscape and meet the people themselves. And I found their stories, you know, really incredible. And so during the time that I had, you know, traveled back and forth, I realized that the country was changing dramatically. And in 2008, I felt that the changes that were happening in Cambodia were overwhelming. And that's when I decided to work on this, you know, documentary, because I wanted to document that change. And I wanted to show the world, you know, what's happening. And I felt that if we waited any longer, if we waited to document this, you know, 10 years from now, it might be too late, because the changes are happening so fast.
Now, making this decision was not an easy decision to make on one level, because it required, I mean, I heard you talk at Sundance about it after the first screening of your film, and I was, you know, just amazed about when you told the story, the effort that you had to put into actually making this film, because people should be clear, it wasn't like you went to Phnom Penh, or you just walked, you know, got a bus and went outside a few miles. You actually went on a trek, sister.
Yes. No, it was really a challenging film to make. We conceived of the idea in 2008, October 2008, but actually started production, full production in 2010, you know, after I finished my last documentary, Inside Job, working as, you know, cinematographer in that film. And I just flew straight, you know, from the Cannes Film Festival, you know, to Cambodia, you know, with a camera, and went searching, you know, for the stories, you know, for this film. And we had to trek through jungles, go to some of the most remote places in Cambodia, you know, to find the families. And we went to a floating village in Kampong Chenang, you know, on the Belay Sap Lake in the river, and found a family, so these family there. And then we had to search for another family, a family of a young woman who was forced to migrate, you know, from the countryside, you know, to the city. And so it took us some time to find these families. But, you know, it was such an organic process. I would never, you know, want to have done it any other way. Like when we were in the jungles, we spoke to so many village chiefs, you know, and we traveled to so many places just to find the right family. And I'm glad we put that effort in, because the families that we found are really remarkable and tell really, truly remarkable stories of their lives.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kalyani Mam, filmmaker-director of A River Changes Course, a beautiful, beautiful film that you shouldn't miss. As soon as you get the chance, rush out and see it. And it was the winner of the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries at Sundance. Now, Kalyani, one of the things, actually, you told a story of you did something like you got a whole gang of motorcycles, you know, and you had you went over seven mountains, and apparently somebody forgot to tell you that the number 22 bus would have gotten you there real easy.
No, there were no buses. I'm glad you brought that up, because in the jungles, the Saf Samor and the women in the film and her family that live in the remote area in the jungle, her village is already remote, but where she lives is even more remote than that. We had to drive into her village, park our car, you know, drive over dirt roads and, you know, very difficult conditions, park our car in the village, and then take 9 motorcycles packed with all our equipment, as well as a generator, and just to power the computer and hard drive, and then all our food and supplies, and then place those motorcycles on a boat, you know, a few trips across the river, the Seisan River, and then climb 9 mountains to reach her village, which is in a very remote place. And the interesting thing is with Saf Samor, and the reason why she lives in such a remote area, you know, is because she and her family had to leave the village. There's the Yali Dam in Vietnam. You know, they built a dam in Vietnam, and every few months they open the floodgates, and all the water floods, you know, comes crashing in and floods the village, and the water is contaminated. So a lot of the livestock were killed, and it ruined their land. And so she and her family decided to move, you know, deeper into the forest to get away from that. And she and a few families settled in this remote area. But as mentioned in the film, it's only a few years' time probably before she'll probably have to move even deeper. And who knows, you know, sooner or later, there's probably nowhere else for her to go. She's already so deep in the forest. And the forests are being cut down all around her.
Well, I want to get into that a little bit deeper in a minute, but I wanted to ask you this. You did another film called Land, Water, Rain. And I wanted to know...
Actually, it's the same film. We just changed the title.
Oh,
yes.
Tricky. Okay, well, yeah. Well, yes. Forget that. I had a whole discussion around that then. Because I was kind of curious. It took you 2 years to do this film. And, you know, the kind of stuff that you went into, which it reminded me of a couple years ago, or maybe it became official less than a couple years ago, the massive change that has occurred on a world scale in terms of the lives of people in various countries that are being deeply impacted and warped by globalization, by imperialism, all this other stuff. There's a question here of like, for the first time, and this is how heavy it is, for the first time in human history, 50% of the people are now living in or around urban areas. And the impact that has on life in general, is that, you know, it's something that really comes out heavily in your film. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's really interesting, the three families, you know, they kind of circle around each other, you know, showing how life used to be a long time ago, and, you know, when people lived in the jungles and were sustainable and living a sustainable life, you know, these indigenous cultures, you know, with very distinct languages and cultures, and, you know, living, you know, off the land, living off the forest, gathering vegetables and fruit from the forest, and also hunting, you know, for wild animals in the forest. So they lived a very sustainable life. But then now people are being thrown off their land, and they don't know where else to go. And we go move on to Kiel Story. And she's living in the countryside, and she's becoming majorly in debt. So she's being forced into the urban areas to work in the factories in order to pay off that debt. And so I think slowly in the film, you can see the movement from our lives, how it used to be, living in harmony with nature and with the forest. And then now most of us are being forced to leave the land and then move to the urban areas. And Cambodia, a lot of people, it used to be that people used to live a very sustainable life, just growing rice in their villages and living off the land. But now, yes, I think definitely, 50% is right on par, you know, that a lot of people are migrating from the countryside and to the cities to find work and opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really affecting and it's changing their lives. You know, for Kiel, for example, you know, she's been forced to move to the city to work in the factories, and she's being separated from her family in the village. Actually, most of the villages in Cambodia are bereft of young people, especially women. young women are moving from the villages into the city to find work, and the villages are only, there's only old people left in the villages. And so you can imagine the impact that will have on villages throughout Cambodia. And that's happening all over the world, you know, not just in Cambodia, but in Latin America, you know, in South America and Africa, you know, and even in the United States, you know, a lot of the rural areas are being emptied. There's a brain drain leaving the rural areas to the urban areas. And I think that it's really, we're beginning to choke the urban areas, you know, with a greater population.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kalyani Mam, the filmmaker and director of A River Changes Course, winner of the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for documentaries up at Sundance, and a really beautiful film, very moving film, and a very important film for people to see in terms of what is the actual impact of all this when you have a system that just only operates in terms of is driven by the chase after profit and what it does to millions and millions and millions and hundreds of millions and billions of people around the world. When you get outside the borders of this country, you know, it's a whole different world for the vast majority of people who are alive today. And this is a beautiful portrayal of what people are going through. Now, Kalyani, let me ask you one thing more on this, on the point about women, because that really struck me.
Yeah.
You know, that was
yeah.
a very sad part. I mean, you could see that, and you had the mother who was, I mean, you captured her. And that's one thing about your film. It's so intimate. You captured the mother as she's watching her daughter leave for the city. And she's a mixed emotion. She knows she has to get the money. At the same time, she's going to miss her daughter emotionally yeah. and physically in terms of even being able to do the kind of farming that they need to do in order to stay alive. And then Q gets into the city, and you captured something in her life. You captured something that's very common to the hundreds of thousands, millions of women, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of women all over the world are doing this, and all those women in Cambodia who are going to Phnom Penh searching for some way to help their family survive. Can you talk about that a little? Because I was really struck even by when you look at the where Q lives, you look at the, and it's
yes,
like cement
exactly.
holes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think her story is really fascinating on so many levels. And I think the first level is just her separation from her family, having to go to a new place to find work. And it's really difficult for her. You know, in the film, she talks about feeling like she's divided in half. You know, she doesn't really know if she belongs in the village. She doesn't really know if she belongs in the city. But at the same time, like you say, you know, she's really searching for an opportunity, you know, to provide for her family. And a lot of them appreciate that opportunity. You know, there's a point in the film which really shocks me. You know, I just couldn't believe it when, you know, I interviewed Q and I asked her, you know, what her dreams are and what she wants out of her life. And she said to me, Long, which means older sister in Khmer, you know, Long, I really want the city to come to my village. You know, I want the factories to come to my village. And I was really shocked by that because we all understand the impact of globalization and development. We all understand the impact that a factory could have on a village like Kyiv, especially the environmental impact and the social impact. You know, what could happen if a factory came to her village? She could be thrown off her land. Many of the villagers could be thrown off their land. You know, the factory residue could affect, you know, the environment in her village. You know, so all of those things went through my mind. But at the same time, I finally understood that for Q, if the factory came to her village, she would no longer be divided in half. You know, she would be whole again, and she would be Q again. She would have her mother, her family around her, you know, and for all the factory, you know, women, you know, who are working in the factories now, this is all that they want. They just want their family with them. There's one woman in the film that I interviewed, and I asked her, so, you know, what are you going to do now? And she says, you know, I need to quit this job. I can't do this anymore. And then I asked her if she had a child, and she said she had a 3-year-old child, and she had been working in the factories for years now. So she hasn't seen her child in a long time. So, for many of them, it's a really complicated issue.
And
they want opportunities. Yeah, they want to work in the factories. They want to make money, but they're also uncertain, you know, about that implication, you know, on their lives.
And, you know, one of the things that happens, it seems to me, is that one of the things that happens is that there's, in addition to the breaking up of the traditional life in the countryside and the land grabs and everything else that's going on, the deforestation, you know, the pollution of the rivers so people can't even fish anymore to make a living. You know, all of those things, in addition to that, where people are driven away from the villages, away from the countryside for one reason or another, there's a certain element of dehumanization that goes along with the sort of incorporation into the machinery of, you know, the machinery of the big corporations and whatnot that are rolling there, and the machinery of the states that actually come in and carry all this out. There's a dehumanization that happens. And I think that was what really struck me about, you have this scene where you go down this alley and there's a spot where women and men can bathe. And then there's just, you look at these rectangular holes in a wall that actually open up into a cave. And then the ignominious treatment of women when they're coming out of work and they're patted down as if they're, you know, going to steal some underwear or something that they're sewing. You know, it was just insane.
It's their lives are really changing, you know, through this. But you know what's interesting about the film, though, is just I never really show that dehumanization. I think that I really try to just show with images, you know, what is taking place.
Right.
And but I never really, you know, express that they're being, you know, dehumanized. I think it's a very complicated issue, and I think one of the things that happens, and you know, which further complicates it, you know, is that despite, you know, the impact that factories are having in Cambodia, despite, you know, the environmental residue, you know, it is empowering women on the one hand. You know, I think that, you know, Keo, along with many of the other women, actually feel empowered by the opportunity to make money and to provide for their families, you know, in a way that they've never been empowered before. And the reason why I reveal this complexity is because, you know, I don't think that development is bad. You know, I think that there should be opportunities for people to work. There should be opportunities for women to provide for their families. But I think it's really about the process in which that development takes place. And that's what I have issue with. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we need to be more aware of how development takes place and that process.
And who it's serving.
And exactly. And who is it serving? On the one hand, but also how it's impacting people's lives. Mm-hmm. You know, we're tearing down forests. You know, we're fishing, you know, the LASAP out of extinction. You know, where people are going into debt, you know, massively. You know, how can we make development something that is helpful and beneficial for everyone and not just for a select few?
You know,
and that is a question that is universal. It's not just in Cambodia. It's in the United States. You know, the question of the 1% versus the 99%. You know, it's in Latin America, South America, as I said before, and all over the world, this is happening, that there's a widening gap, you know, between the rich and poor. How do we decrease that gap? How do we bring people more to, you know, a parity with each other so that all of us can live a beautiful existence?
You know, Kalyani, in my mind, it is only going to happen through a revolution, fundamental change in this society to build a whole new world. I have to tell you right now, though, I got one last question for you.
Sure.
One minute, and we'll have to run. But basically, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the young guy that went out to be a slave to the Chinese contract labor, which is an example of what happens when the factories do come to the countryside, actually.
Exactly.
Very, very moving thing. But there was a woman in the film who said that looking out at the forest and as it was, you know, just ruined, destroyed, thinned out, whatever, deforestation. And she looked at it and said, you know, we used to be afraid of wild animals and ghosts. Now I'm not afraid of them because they're not here anymore. Now I'm afraid of people. Let's talk about that in 1 minute, why you put that in there and what it meant to you.
Actually, I was really amazed, you know, when she said that. You know, it really brought home to me the fact that, you know, we're so removed, you know, from nature now. You know, I mean, it made me aware that her life, you know, had completely changed, you know, overnight, you know, that, you know, she was no longer, you know, rambling and walking through the forest and, you know, searching for food, you know, in the forest where she belongs. But now she's, you know, dependent on, and now in the future, you know, she and her children will have to depend on companies, you know, to make a living. And I think that, you know, her, what she says really reflects, you know, the stage that we are in right now in the industrialized world, you know, where we're no longer connected to the land, you know, we're no longer connected to the forest and the water and nature, you know, that we are surrounded by this urban landscape. And, you know, for her, this is a frightening moment. For us, we're accustomed to it, but I think we've kind of lost touch, you know, with that frightening moment that she's having right now. You know, for her, this is a turning point in her life. You know, she had never, you know, had this experience before, you know, of having people come to her land. You know, but I think for us, you know, we've all almost become desensitized to it. So it really captured me on many different levels, you know, when she said what she said. Because I think that it helped me to return to that moment, you know, when she is, you know, when the change is happening in her life.
Now tell me something. In the villages, is there actually an element of communal land, or are they privately owned plots?
Yeah, so where she lives, these are communal lands. You know, these are indigenous lands that are owned by the villagers themselves, mm-hmm. and they are termed communal land, and they're protected. And according to the land law in Cambodia, these are protected areas, you know, because the people have been living there for so long. You know, but all land in Cambodia are owned by the government, even if they are communal land. And so the government has the right to do what it wills with the land. Of course, you know, with restrictions because of the law. But, you know, in Cambodia, the law is rarely enforced. You know, so what happens is that these communal lands are being turned over, you know, to companies to do as they will.
All right, Kalyani, we're going to have to wrap up at this moment, unless you have something more you wanted to add in.
I think that's great. It was really wonderful speaking with you, Michael.
Yeah, you too. And hope to talk to you again soon. And okay. Why don't you, before you go, why don't you give people your website where they can find out more about the film?
You can find out more about the film at www.ariverchangescourse.com.
All right. Thank you very much, Kalyani.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care now. We've just been talking with Kalyani Mom. Kalyani is the director of the film A River Changes Course, which tells the story of the impact of globalization on the people of Cambodia and, by extension, the people in the rest of the world as well. All right, and that brings us to the end of yet another edition of The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my board op for today, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. And remember, you know, if you're good with a society where almost 2.4 million people are in jail, with a world of grotesque inequality, slums and sweatshops, an epidemic of violence against women and environmental devastation, if you're good with all that, then get back to me when you find it intolerable, because that's who I want to talk to. And if you're not fine with this world of horrors, you want to make sure that you're tuning in next week to catch the final installment of the interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So looking forward to hearing from you when it's all over. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with James Blood Olmor talking about ain't going to fatten frogs for snakes no more, something we all got to be thinking about.
Sure do, man. But I bet you my bottom dollar I'm not fattening no more frogs today. We'll be right back.